This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 7:08. You are with Kelvin and Ayman, and we are moving on to our next story, and that will be about the Global Peace Index. We're talking about Malaysia as a peaceful country and what it means for the economy. So it was reported after Malaysia is actually ranked as the 16th most peaceful country in the world by the Global Peace Index.
I believe that. I believe we are 16th is an appropriate ranking.
Do you feel zen right now, Ayman?
I do. I feel so peaceful right now. So this index that we are talking about, it looks at three domains, which are the extent to which a country is involved in internal and external conflicts. The second one is the level of harmony or discord. And the third one is, you know, the country's military build-up and the level of peacefulness in the country. And it found that we are not only more peaceful than, you know, places like Sweden and Norway, but we are also in the top five peaceful countries in the Asia Pacific as well.
Of course, cause to celebrate, reason for celebrate, Defense Minister Mohammad Sabu welcomed the findings of the report and said that this is something that should be highlighted as it will attract foreign investors and tourists to the country, which raises an interesting question about the different ways a peace index like this can help us in terms of the economy. And I think the interesting addition to this year's GPI, the index, is that it includes research on climate change and peace, right? So they're trying to understand how climate conditions can affect societal stability and its potential to lead to violent conflict. And I guess this also sort of ties in with how we should now view the economy in the 21st century, right? That we have to consider sustainability. We have to consider the environmental impact, the business decisions and economic policies that we plan to have. So it's quite nice that I guess the GPI itself is also updating itself to reflect how the sentiment is at this point in time.
Yeah, especially at a time when climate change is very much linked to economic well-being as well. So if the effects of climate change affects industries and sectors and, you know, results in the displacement of workers, for example, it will, you know, affect the health of that industry and the general well-being of the worker as well. And, you know, as an extension to that, it will also, you know, influence the decision of foreign investors, you know, whether or not, you know, this is, you know, the right place for us to, you know, to inject our money in. So yeah, having this index, it does give an indication as to the sort of policies or the state on the ground of like how we are doing in terms of general peace. And I mean, I don't so much agree with the military might and all that, but you know, the fact that we are not so involved in external conflicts, the fact that internally there is relatively a low amount of discord as well, it does help in terms of you know, being attractive to foreign businesses and foreign investments, which is a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think just also looking at perhaps, well, when we look at this index, when we look at this rating, 16th place, do you feel it on a personal level is also another thing, right?
Yeah,
you know, because they are trying to also gauge whether in the report people feel safe walking alone at night, and also whether if you have levels of trust in the police, whether they execute their duty as well, whether you sort of imagine them being able to protect you when it's needed, right? So, you know, if you have any thoughts about this, you know, let's use that gauge that they use, walking alone. Do you feel safe walking alone at night? Let us know. You can call us 7733-2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. How would you personally define that peace in Malaysia? Call us. After this, we'll actually be speaking to Lawrence Todd, Head of Research and Development at IDEAS, to talk about this ranking. Keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's 7:13. You are with Kelvin and Ayman on the Evening Edition, and we are talking about the Global Peace Index. We did quite well. We are the 16th most peaceful country in the world. And in line with that, Mat Sabu has just said that this should be a fact that we have to highlight because it can help us in terms of the economy. So taking an angle and taking that line and to help us understand that is Lawrence Todd, Head of Research and Development at the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs. Lawrence, thank you for being on the show.
Hi.
So first off, can you give us your first impressions of the ranking? Were there any placements that stood out to you?
Well, I mean, I would say overall it was sort of broadly aligned with what I would expect. I think, you know, one thing to say is I was quite pleased because, you know, quite often these indexes have a real bias or a skew towards Europe. And of course, there are many European countries that feature highly on the list. But I think it is good that Southeast Asia, you know, is notable actually in the index for being, you know, for being a set of quite peaceful countries, you know, and you've mentioned Malaysia is 16 and Singapore's in the top 10, I think, but also Laos and some other countries, you know, score pretty well. And I think that's accurate. You know, sometimes my colleagues laugh at me when I say I actually feel much safer walking around the streets of Southeast Asia than I do of London or even Paris. So I think it's good that, you know, these indexes are actually picking some of that up. I think in terms of the overall report, I mean, there's two things, I don't know, sorry if you've already discussed this, but that really struck me, I think, worth highlighting. So one was that overall the index has declined since 2008, but not people feel physically secure. They don't feel physically less safe, but the levels of stress and anxiety and just general dissatisfaction and not feeling at peace in that sense, that's what's driven this kind of gradual decline since 2008. And I think that's, you know, really interesting, you know, and I think we can see evidence of that in the Malaysian context as well. This sort of move from worrying about physical threats and personal sort of physical security through to sort of mental stress and anxiety. And at the same time, they pointed out that this is the first time they've included suicide, the economic impact of suicide in the report. And they actually find that suicide is a bigger economic cost to the global economy than armed conflict, which I thought was really striking. And when you, especially when you connect those two ideas, it feels like since 2008, we've been in this path where we're sort of physically secure, but maybe emotionally and mentally more at war than ever before. So I think that was quite striking.
I guess, how would you make sense of that transition of stresses, right, where it's no longer, where it's no longer about the physical, but rather it's about the mental, it's about the emotional, and I guess it's stuff that is essentially intangible.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a real puzzle that's at the heart of, you know, so much of, you know, the global political economy. I mean, particularly in the West, but I think also in Malaysia, where, you know, again, 2008 feels like always is the benchmark because of the global financial crisis. But I mean, at its heart, there's been a shift, really, where I think, you know, it's best characterized by the idea that, you know, people growing up now feel like they're not going to do as well as their parents, and generally they don't have the same deal that the generation before them did of unending growth. I think when you marry that with concerns around the climate, sort of stagnation of wages, rising living costs, I mean, it all adds up to a sense of, yeah, okay, it's great that we're not fighting, but is this all there is? So I think that's really striking, and I think it adds the report credibility that it reflects on that, because I think that's really, from a sort of global perspective in terms of overall levels of society and what we're sort of striving for in terms of building good societies, I think that's really the key issue we need to look at.
So how important is a peace index in the realm of economics?
Well, you know, I think it's, you know, it'll be one of the first things that people think about, you know, before you, you know, whether as a business, you know, looking to take your products to market. I mean, you know, earliest history, you know, the first thing you want to understand is, you know, is this a stable and secure place to do business? As a consumer, you know, it's whether you're safe to, you know, conduct your business and so on. So look, I think it's, you know, it's really fundamental in terms of being able to have a successful economy that there's a sense of peace and stability and security. I mean, I think it's not everything, you know, and it's quite interesting, you know, comparing some of the countries on this list to where there's the most vibrant economic growth. You know, there are probably countries that are pretty violent that still manage to register high levels of growth. I mean, that tends to be the pattern more in the Americas, including in the United States. Whereas there are other countries that maybe are content with a slightly slower pace of growth, but are much more stable and secure and peaceful. So I think it's important not to draw a direct one-to-one correlation between them. Mm-hmm. But of course, when we're talking about, you know, really fundamental threats to personal security on a daily basis, you know, for people who at the struggle in Afghanistan and Yemen and some of these places that have really seen terrible conflict. You know, of course, that's an absolute, you know, inhibits any sense of economic opportunity, absolutely.
And how would you measure the economic impact of peace?
Oh, well, you know, there's always ways to measure these things if you if you want to get creative on your methodologies. I mean, I think, you know, the approach they take into this index is they look at, you know, what is the, it seems, I think, largely a sort of opportunity cost idea. So, you know, how much GDP is expended on conflict and how would that be redirected? You know, the slightly more morbid side of it is, you know, how many lives are prematurely cut short and what could be their contribution if, you know, they lived a full life. So, you know, once you understand the level of armed conflict, the level of expenditure of the respective militaries and, you know, unfortunately, the number of casualties, then you can start to translate that into direct economic impact. When you start getting into slightly more, subjective ideas, you know, you guys were talking about how safe do you feel walking at home, you know, you then have to try and translate that into, okay, well, if people don't walk at home, how much does that slow down, you know, nighttime trade? What impact does that have on certain, you know, on taxi services and so on? And you have to start making assumptions to try to reflect those kind of dynamics. So it will start to get a bit tangential, I'm sure, but the kind of core idea is, you know, how much opportunity is wasted because people are either too afraid to go out and engage in the economy, they're too busy fighting a war, or unfortunately they've already been a casualty of violence. You know, I think that's the kind of core idea of how you would measure the economic cost of violence. And
I'm just wondering, are there any economic factors that we can use to perhaps predict if a country might fall into conflict or if they'll be able to maintain peace?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, we sort of touched on that a bit before. I mean, I would be a bit cautious about drawing too close a parallel. I mean, I think we see very peaceful countries that have quite slow economies and, as I said, some economies that are, you know, powerhouses that are actually quite violent places. So I think we've got to distinguish between a sort of level of violence that is tolerated within the society, more or less. I mean, that doesn't mean, you know, people are absolutely okay with it, but a level of violence that is within the overall acceptability within society versus a level of violence that causes the society itself to break down, which is, of course, what you see at the low end of the index when we're talking about states that are, you know, absolutely in conflict. So I think at that point, you know, clearly there's a very direct impact it will have on the economy. But the relationship above that level, I think, is a bit more nuanced. And I'm not sure you can directly read across, you know, an economic indicator into how likely the risk of sort of breakdown in peace is. I think, you know, one thing to add at this point is it's quite interesting. And I mean, I don't take this the wrong way. I'm not advocating for violence or anything. But historically, one of the, I don't want to say positive impacts, one of the interesting developments post-major conflicts has actually been the effective redistribution of wealth. Mm-hmm. So you might remember there was a lot of excitement about Piketty's work on inequality. And because one of the things that he pointed out was actually that you had this huge accumulation of wealth towards top 1% until basically the Second World War. And then you had this massive devastation, and then actually that resulted in a redistribution of wealth. Now, we obviously need to find a better way than having a wealth to achieve that. But, you know, another flip side of that is, you know, what happened in Japan is after the Second World War, you'd had such a crisis that there was sort of enough space for the government to take really radical action. So what happened in Japan is they actually redistributed a lot of the land to a lot of, so directly to citizens. So they broke up a lot of the big farms and handed out small parcels of land. And that actually triggered a massive period of agricultural growth in Japan. And it's interesting because the same thing happened in Korea and Taiwan, and is often credited with how the Northeast Asian economies managed to achieve such rapid growth, which is that, you know, they had this kind of big redistribution of wealth, basically, after the major conflict. So, I mean, that's not me saying that there's a you know, a positive side to conflict or anything, but I think it's just interesting to reflect on it and to see that there's not a sort of one-to-one relationship between economic opportunity and conflict in that way.
You know, I guess just on this very thought, right, there are some studies that would perhaps suggest that economic inequality also somewhat fuels instability, it fuels conflict, and perhaps even today we are kind of seeing some signs of that, right? Wage inequality is at its peak right now. You know, in the US, for example, there are movements to fight against billionaires in some ways. So are these indicators sort of also suggesting that perhaps a lead-in into a time that we might see less peace? And how can we, you know, perhaps find ways to get around that, right? As you've said, you know, war is definitely not the way, conflict is not the way. There must be better ways to do it.
Sure. You know, it's really interesting because I think generally, I mean, it's kind of complex to draw conclusions from history. You know, the data is always more mixed than you'd want it to be. But
yeah.
I have heard a lot of people make the argument that actually, you know, inequality itself has never been a trigger for conflict. And what's interesting is you hear people on both sides make that point. So you say, well, inequality has never been a trigger for conflict. It's not that bad. You know, people don't mind it that much. But then you also say, well, inequality has never been a trigger for conflict because in unequal societies, those at the bottom don't have the kind of control of the levers to, you know, bring about that kind of conflict. So it's quite interesting. I think the interpretation of the history on that point is quite debated. But I think, you know, it kind of comes back to what we were talking about at the beginning, which is that this index saying that, look, since 2008, the thing that's really driven the decline in peace has been a sort of sense of disenchantment and disillusionment and anxiety. And I think we have to accept that that has fed into instability. I mean, one doesn't want to get, you know, too political, but if you look at the recent situation in the Middle East with Iran, you know, that wouldn't be happening in a world where Donald Trump had been elected president, and that wouldn't have happened if we hadn't had 2008 and the impact that's had on, you know, sentiment in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to recognize that there is this sort of chain of causation between disenchantment, disillusionment, and inequality, and kind of physical instability in the world. So yeah, I mean, I think what's difficult is trying to discern any really concrete patterns that allow you to kind of predict or map one-to-one these kind of indicators to kind of future economic opportunities, because I think the relationships are very, very complex. But I think it's definitely a good, you know, conversation to have, and I think it's good to reflect on, you know, and celebrate like Malaysia's position. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's really good to have that recognition that Malaysia is a very safe and secure place to be. I mean, I personally feel like there's more reasons than that to attract investors to come to Malaysia, and more the government can do to stimulate that than point to the fact that it's, you know, safe and secure. But still, it's something to celebrate.
Lawrence, thank you so much for your thoughts.
Thank you.
You just heard from Lawrence Todd, Head of Research and Development at IDEAS, with his thoughts on the economic significance of the Global Peace Index. And we have some thoughts here just about the index. Locke says, don't mention a night, I feel unsafe in a day. Faisal says, in the real world, Malaysians are very peaceful, but on social media, we are bordering toxic, which makes me wonder, are we faking it? What we do and what we do behind the screen is completely different. And to that, you know what? I agree. Sometimes I just have to take a bit of time off from social media because it can get a bit noisy and it doesn't really reflect what's happening in the real world.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we are consciously faking it in real life, but I think that once we get behind the screen on social media, it feels like, you know, there's this huge veil that's being lifted that, oh, we can be someone different. There's no accountability on social media and all that. Yeah, so that does contribute to, you know, what this two-sidedness of Malaysians on social media.
And we also have this final message here from Mudif Malik, who feels that we should be higher on the ranks, if anything. We have no major natural disasters, practically no gun-related crimes, no school shootings. Yeah, the police are a bit corrupt, but this is the case worldwide, honestly. We live harmoniously despite the diversity. What few discord only springs out due to the political extremist few. Our people have high levels of empathy in general, as proven by how many good Samaritans rush to help every time road accidents occur and don't walk in the dark, mud, rampant cesspools, and you'd be perfectly safe. We don't go to war with anyone, and the sole country we refuse to have a relationship with is a notorious war crime committer. We should be top 10 at least for me. Munir, thank you so much. And that is just a glowing review of what Malaysia is. And you can continue sending in your thoughts to us, 018-789-8899. So WhatsApp, you can tweet us at BFM Radio. You are listening to The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. BFM 89.9, the business station.